Thank you so much for coming. It's so good to see you in person. And I know that there's a lot of factors that affect whether we show up anymore, but it's delightful to see you. So before I start giving the talk, I would like to make some acknowledgments and express some dedication. So first of all, for those who throughout time have contributed to our arrival together in this moment, including our spiritual ancestors, our immigrant ancestors, and our indigenous ancestors, and our current benefactors who support Clouds and Waters' physical home and its practice community. Thank you. Thank you all. Secondly, I'd like to recognize also the ancient twisted karma of anger, deceit, killing, torture, theft, and abuse for which our ancestors and now we as their descendants are responsible. May we take responsibility for purifying that karma and its fruit and for planting wholesome seeds that all beings may be free from suffering. And then next, I'd like to thank Bhante Hanapola Luna Ratana, who wrote a book called Mindfulness in Plain English, and who provided the topic for this talk, which I've entitled, Don't Think, See. And the reason I've entitled that is because in my daily reading, my daily reader, which usually has short quotes that help me reflect on my practice and refresh it, I read one day that very short phrase, don't think, see. And my body really responded to it. It kind of went funk. It's like, oh. It was just like a oh. And I've learned that when my body responds that way, that it's something to pay attention to. The first thing that came to mind around my practice was a memory quite a long time ago now of looking for a parking spot on a narrow street in uptown Minneapolis. And it was a street that had cars on both sides of the road. So you probably have had some experience just like that where you can barely make it down the middle of the road and you're also looking for parking and maybe you're not that great at parallel parking, so I was a little nervous. And all of a sudden I realized, and it was one of those other thunk moments, I think, and that's why it came up for me when I read this phrase again, was I realized I was getting angry and resentful because other people got parking spots right in front of the building they were going to. And not only that, the thunk was just sort of watching the resentment and the story and the phrases. I mean, it just sort of was odd and not helpful. And I was really starting to get some energy going around it. And all of a sudden I realized, well, you never go up to the front of the building to see if there's an empty parking spot. You just assume that it won't be there. And somebody else who you don't know, that probably never met, will have gotten that space that you wanted for yourself. And I just all of a sudden, it was like a little moment of nirvana. It was like, wow, I'm afraid of being disappointed by driving up to the parking space in front of the building and seeing if it's empty. And ever since, I've realized, you know, that's that instinct. I'm sure we all do some of that where we think, oh, I'm not going to bother because I know. So there's this little phrase in my head that says, I know, there is suffering, I know. But the experience of that is so much richer, so much more impactful, and capable in that moment and many moments going forward of freeing us from a view, a belief, and just finding out. And there's certainly a risk to that. We might run into something that we don't like. But along with reading a daily reader, I've also been preparing for class that Kathleen, Avila, and I are going to teach in September on the Four Noble Truths. And this is a class that is normally in Zen in America, and I just assume that it's probably true in other places as well, where the Four Noble Truths are considered to be a beginner's teaching. So it's like, well, you got to know the Four Noble Truths, so we'll tell you about them. But then we'll go on to really deep stuff, you know? more important stuff. And there is a Theravadin teacher that I've had the opportunity to meet a couple of times, who's written a very slim volume. I mean, it's like maybe an eighth of an inch thick on the Four Noble Truths. And he just has a real way of connecting, at least for me, and I think with others too. He writes in a very human, connective way about the Four Noble Truths. And what he says, I think he's still alive, but I'm not sure. He could be dead, he's that old. But he was an heir of Ajahn Chah's and his Thai forest tradition, which is quite rigorous. Now, this is out in a tropical forest with bugs and snakes and bees, and that's where they practice. They don't have a lot of shelter most of the time. The usual picture of Ajahn Chah sitting out on a platform in a robe with his shoulder exposed, and that's it. He's a classic Buddhist monk. So I have been reading that text, and I think it's a very good one for helping us understand some of the aspects of don't think, see. So please just, you know, kind of give your mind a little message that says, just listen. So he starts out by talking about the three-part structure of each of the Four Noble Truths. And like the Four Noble Truths, it sounds deceptively simple. He says, okay, first there's the statement of an insight. And that first noble truth, the statement is, there is suffering. And then the next thing is, there's a responsibility related to that statement. And that's usually, in the case of the first noble truth, it is dukkha, which is a more complex word than suffering in its original language of the Buddha. Dukkha is to be understood. And then the third part is, dukkha has been understood, or the truth of dukkha has been understood. Now, what he says is, each of the Four Noble Truths has these three insight statements. And I think it's very easy to kind of go, meh, you know, there is suffering. Well, let's not dwell on it. But that's the whole point of C. We spend a lot of time not dwelling on it, even though we're right in the middle of it, and it's with us at all times. So then he goes on to talk about it. And he says, normally, let me see if I can find this. I love the way he puts this. He said, usually the way we think about this truth is, I'm suffering. I don't want to suffer. I meditate and I go on retreats to get out of suffering, but I am still suffering and I don't want to be suffering. How can I get out of suffering? What can I do to get rid of suffering? And what he very carefully, and with a smile, I think probably says is, that is not, there is suffering. And the reason that it's not, there is suffering, and the insight thereof, is because it's all tangled up with I. So this statement of insight has everything to do with recognizing, experiencing, inviting, embracing. Being human has everything to do with trying to spend as much time getting things we want and getting rid of things we don't want. And that, to shift from that thinking about suffering, it's like, yeah, I do suffer. Now that you point this out, there's more suffering than I thought there was. And just exactly what do we mean about suffering? That's thinking. I love thinking. I totally get into thinking. I can sometimes spend so much time thinking that I don't actually exist in the present. I was married for 21 years, and when I would drive with my spouse, sometimes he would look over at me when I was not driving and I was in the rider's seat, and he said, who are you talking to? Even though I wasn't saying anything. But he could just tell from what was going on my face and in my body what I was thinking. So this is a deep attachment for me, but I'm not the only one. I have company. So let's keep going about why I think this is such a good way to approach this whole insight of don't think, see. I'm a place to hold on. There we go. So what he says is this whole language of there is versus I am is a key seeing. He says we all suffer. In fact, the result of birth is being continually in touch with pain and pleasure. We're continually experiencing pain and pleasure. Now, that just doesn't sound pleasant, right? It's like, maybe the pleasure, but right away, we're seeing. Now, to be able to sit with that, because usually what we do is we say, oh, well, then I'm not going to think about that. I mean, that pretty much happens to me every time I read the news. I'm just not going to think about that. Okay, I'll think about it, but it's very disturbing, and I don't like the very disturbing. So, okay, how long am I going to get myself before I get rid of freedom? So that's right there. That's the suffering. Right there. Right in the middle of it. So can I go into this second insight of dukkha or suffering is to be understood. And Ajahn Sumedho talks about standing under, to take that word understanding and kind of turn it upside down. Because what we do with that I is essentially we make it our own. Instead of doing our best to simply observe, just observe how that works. And that's a little bit of what was happening the day that I had my parking epiphany. It was like, I'm making this all up. I don't have to think like this. I could do something different. I mean, there's still the parallel parking curve, but you know, one moment at a time. So how do we make our peace with always being exposed to pain and pleasure because we're human? It's like you got born, therefore pain and pleasure. Exposure comes with the package, not optional. Well, the Buddha used the phrase, so it is, which I really like. It's not like, well, that's the way things are. There's something about that phrase that doesn't stand under. It doesn't sit down beside, oh, here's a pain part. Here's a pleasure part. And just look how many moments where we can just see how pain and pleasure arise. So how is this helpful? Well, Ajahn Sumedho points out that we spend a lot of time essentially in denial of suffering. So there we are. I don't want to know. I just want to get rid of it. Now, if you look at the news, if you look at history, that is the history of human beings. I want this, and I don't want this other thing that's painful, and I want to get rid of it. We have a whole altar at the Hokuoki Zen Practice Center that through practicing together and standing under things a little bit contains the most common creatures and plants that we kill so that we can practice peacefully. So there's a mouse on there. There's a mosquito on there. There's a tick on there. There's weeds, like thistles on there. The altar is there to help us be grateful for there is life and death. To be able to see our part in it and take responsibility for it. I spent my first of now going on 4 years of living at Hokuoki, counting every mouse I caught in my quarters. And that was, in that first year, was about 102 mice. So this is life as we know it, right? Things come along and we have to make a decision. Having 102 mice in your living space isn't very workable for humans. And so to essentially say, if you're here, this is what will happen. If you're out there, something different will happen. At least the person or the animal or the whatever, whether it's weather or another creature, will be associated with the death. But it really just requires, it's not a small thing to kill a mouse. And that's the instinct. It's like, I climb up on top of the chair and it's, I mean, it just happens. I've gotten to see myself do that, you know, just leap up and try to get away from the mouse. And now I have a somewhat different reaction, but the mouse still ends up dead if it's in the room and it steps in for some peanut butter. I think I better be careful about that one. I'm going to move on a little bit. I think you've been to that point. So this, so it is, and essentially having the seeing to realize that there is another choice beside denial of suffering or getting rid of it. There is another response beside fly swatter whack. If we're there for the fly swatter whap part, because I'm not usually there when the mouse gets caught, but I just recently had an experience when I was being a cook for the sashimi that we had, Hokkyoji, and we had some total of 2 flies in the kitchen. But they were really annoying. And I think it took me, I don't know, 3 or 4 days. And I was standing there and I was feeling tired and somewhat impatient and a little tense. And the fly came up and I had a towel on my shoulder and it went. And miraculously, I actually killed the fly, which usually doesn't happen. And what I noticed, because I was doing a little bit of practice with this don't think see, was there was a little bit of satisfaction. And then right on the tail of that, compassion, a sadness, a recognition. There you go. You just killed another creature. You took a lifetime vow not to take it away of killing. And it was because one fly that never landed on you just kind of hung out in the air around you. So look at this, because this is not the only or last time that you have done this. And there's pride here. There is pleasure in killing this fly. Now, I would like to tell you that that was my last fly. But later on in the sashimi, Kathleen and I were talking about the flies. And, you know, it was one of these kind of conversations, right? Damn flies. And just because I knew I could, all of a sudden I found myself, whack, I killed another fly. And I was there for that too. And the first thing that came, it brings tears to my eyes. The first thing that came was, I need to not do that again. So that gets us into the second noble truth, refraining, denying suffering and grasping at temporary pleasures. But it was very important for me to see how thoughtlessly I acted. So that's what this seeing, not just thinking. I don't think of myself as a continual fly killer. Or, you know, a killer. And yet, things die so that I can live. and I think I know about that, but when I'm really present with the experience, it's a different experience. And that's karma right there. That's karma. Not that it happened, but that I chose to preserve it and say, this is so. This is so. And it wasn't just the me connection. It's that this is so. I think probably every moment of our lives, something like this is happening. There is killing of flies. There is pleasure and pain. So that starts helping to ground us in appropriate action. What's the appropriate response? So this seeing is about really accepting, holding, embracing, taking it in, letting it affect one's experience and value it. In one of the talks that happened during the Sesshin, one of the participants relating to, I think, some personal grief said, why do I have to feel it in every cell of my body? So this is this denial story that goes on. So one of the things is really not seeing that we have this, that essentially what we are after, so this grasping at pleasure, is something that kind of the story behind that is, I want to be happy all the time. I want to get enlightened and not have anything that I don't want to have happen. And while we can know that and maybe, you know, kind of laugh at ourselves, the implications of that are not something that we usually take in, nor do we wish to take them in. We don't want to stand under that truth and see exactly how it works. Stay there from the beginning to the end of that moment. So, the insight that dukkha must be understood is really recognizing clearly and preferably closer to the moment when it's happening how broad and deep our stories are, our views are. So if I say view, I think of something like, are you a Republican or a Democrat? No. And with that, what happens? There's a whole book on each one of those and what that means about you, right? From your standpoint yourself and from other people's standpoints, from their points of view. But being in this moment, really not running away from this moment, making it really an effort to be continuously mindful, continuously willing to stand in this moment, whatever happens, is a matter of tiny moments. So I learned, fortunately, from a housemate I had, that I have a very particular idea about where everything in the refrigerator goes. and exactly how the dishwasher should be stacked. And I am so brazen as to take things in the refrigerator and say, well, this doesn't belong there, and put it someplace else. And until my housemate said, would you please stop moving my stuff to the refrigerator? And I was just barely cognizant of it. It was like, well, you know, the celery's going to get dry if you put it here or something like that. But the third or the fourth time she asked me to do that because it was so unconscious, I realized that's really egotistical. I mean, this is really all about, I want it to be this way, so I'm going to make it that way without any regard for anyone else. And it's like, wow, I'm beginning not to like myself so much. And Ajahn Sumedho, bless him, says, now don't go there. Don't go to this I'm a terrible person thing, because that's not there is suffering. That's I am suffering. How do I get rid of it? Oh, no, now I'm a terrible person. Now I've got to work on that. Well, that's just another form of thinking instead of seeing. I did ultimately ask my housemate if I could have her permission to be in charge of where everything went in the dishwasher. And she granted me that permission. And in time, I found it less appealing. First of all, that meant I had to put everything into the dishwasher. You know, these things have implications. So as we work with the moments in this way, these tiny moments, there's so much in each of them. That's where we begin to actually experience compassion for all things, because we're all going through this together. And that's the one thing, irrespective of anything else, that clearly every single time we look at it, we can see this is something that I share with all beings. And that's part of what acknowledgments and dedications are about from my standpoint. I mean, it's like when I first heard about stolen land acknowledgments, I thought, well, we've been stealing land from each other since there were human beings. But then I thought, and how would you feel about your land being stolen? I mean, it wasn't just in the case of indigenous peoples. It wasn't just land. It was an entire livelihood. It was everything that a human being needs to live and thrive. And we did it by force because we made up a view that since we dress better than you do, or at least differently, you know, in a more formal way, we have these habits. And then we find out that our ancestors went through the same thing. So once we really get in touch with how suffering works in the moments that we have access to and see, then we see, oh, everybody's. And when we let that enter our muscles and our thinking and our whole being, then there is. This is included in my, not even my existence. This is included. There is suffering. And then in a way, you can calm down and realize that there are options. That there are views. I had another experience related to the machine where I'd been out shopping late. I was getting all the dry goods first on one day and preparing to get all the things that could rot and melt on the next day. And I got to the kitchen on the afternoon when another group had left. And I went to put things away. It's like 7 o'clock at night. I'm exhausted, a little frustrated, trying to find which aisle has what, blah, blah, blah. And everything is not where it belongs. I can't find things. We've run out of things. There's a broken this over there. And I'd probably spent at least a half an hour before all of a sudden I said, whoa, you are really making yourself miserable. You're tired, you need a rest, and you're sitting here just getting yourself mad and resentful every moment, recognizing it, going on to the next moment, and doing it all over again. Well, that's part of seeing areas suffering. We insist on it. I insisted on it. I kept choosing it. I couldn't get rid of it. I couldn't drop it. And again, up comes compassion. It's like, well, what kind of place were they in when they left? And I've been in that place, so that makes it particularly easy for me. It's kind of like, okay, ice cream is the first thing on the list. No, whatever it is, there's not a lot of attention to what can I remember where this went and put it there as a nice thing to do for somebody, you know, or just as a decent thing to do. Right there, again, the judgment. It's just continually there, but it doesn't have to be a problem. Ajahn Sumedho talks about tolerating pain. He doesn't use the word tolerate, actually. It's just, there is pain. Recognize it. There is pain. It happens. It's included. And he says, you know, we are capable of turning every moment into, but, you know, somebody's pulling out my fingernails. He says, well, you don't have to wait till somebody actually is pulling out your fingernails to get in touch with and agree to work with pain, just as it is up there. So as he says, seeing really, he says, don't wait for somebody to pull out your fingernails to practice trying with little things. So these little things like flies, like resentments about the refrigerator, like, you know, insistence on this is where the plates go and the way they go, the direction they go. You can see the science of the dishwasher. You know, it's those things that really are conditioning us. So when we get to the part where our fingernails are being pulled out, then we have the possible capacity to actually see the really big part of that, which is, how does he say, as long as you think that you are suffering because of another person, you have not understood the first noble truth. To understand suffering is to see clearly that it is our reaction to the fingernail puller, not the fingernail puller itself. I continually forget something that is part of a view I have. If I get enlightenment, everything will be good after that. It's sort of where I started. I started in exactly the place of I don't want this. I was going someplace with that. It's the fingernail puller's fault. That's where I was going with this. No. As long as that's true, it's the Viktor Frankl kind of quote, which is, I have a choice. Not I. But there is choice. And that choice is there is suffering next. We can leave it be right where it is. I'm not looking for the fingernailing pulling apart. I'm not looking for my third round of ovarian cancer like a friend of mine. I'm not looking for the death of my 12-year son, which is another person I met. But it's there, and we can move on to the next moment. We have to. We're already there. So to really acceptance actually isn't something that we can really decide to do. What we can do is decide to really see. To just recognize that things are as they are. This is. Okay. Last couple of things to notice. Pleasure and displeasure. Tarshan Samito says, when I look at pleasure, what I realize is it kind of makes me selfish. I stop thinking about how my actions affect others. Like this is my refrigerator moment. So, and on top of that, even when we get everything we want, there's still something missing. I mean, think about it. Well, it's raining though. No, it's something. That's what happens when we get caught in that pleasure and displeasure. When we can really practice with the small things and just staying with what's going on right now that we can see, that we're capable of seeing. Because that puts us in touch with the suffering part. What happens when we try to fight life the way it's happened? When we object to it? It's a very unsettling and uncomfortable position. And we have a choice to just let the celery in that bag and that part of the refrigerator go by. Or just tap into our understanding that this person that I don't like, or this person that I have a reaction to for no reason I even know, is just being your person, and I can let that go. It's not even, letting go is almost like too much. It's got too much I in it. We can just notice it got done while I wasn't having a view. So he also cautions us about acceptance, because he said this just recognition and this presence with doesn't have an advocation. So I don't sort of go ooh to desires. You know how we do that? It's like, oh, I did that again, wanting something that I shouldn't want. And we do that even in our deepest meditation. We have this whole thing about wanting non-being and wanting pleasure. If we look carefully at the moment, then it's possible to simply go to the next moment, which is different, even really, than seeing. It's just not messing with the one that's already, the train that already went by. The moment that already went by. Not getting, I get a picture of being kayaking in a river where I'm going through water and avoiding rocks, and then all of a sudden I decide, oh no! And like try to hold on to the rock while the river is running in the other direction. It can't be done, but I can sure get really banged up and suffer a lot in the process of trying to hang on to it. So it's 10:20, And I wish I'd left a little more time for you guys to make comments and ask questions, but I didn't. There it is.